Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to the Lizelle Wellbeing Show. And in this week's episode, I am chatting to the brilliant chartered psychologist and author, Kimberly Wilson. Now, alongside her thriving private practice, Kimberly is a governor of the Tavistock and Portman NHS Mental Health Trust and formerly led the therapy service at HMP and YOI Holloway, which at the time was Europe's largest women's prison. She is truly an amazing, amazing woman and a fount of knowledge when it comes to mental health and the simple things that we can all do to keep our brains fit and healthy. Once a finalist on the Great British Bake Off, amazing, and with a degree in nutrition, Kimberly loves her food and is particularly passionate about food and lifestyle and how it interacts with our mental health. Now, I have to say, we have just had the most fascinating, mood-boosting, and in some parts, enraging conversation. So I'm really looking forward to hearing your thoughts on Instagram after the show. And don't forget that if you'd like to watch our chat today, the video podcast is available on YouTube. So without further ado, please let's hear it from Kimberly. So Kimberly, a very warm welcome to my podcast. Oh my goodness, I've been stalking you for a while actually, so I'm really interested and pleased that you made the time to be with us today. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you for having
me. Can we start with just a little bit of background about you? I mean, obviously I've given you a big build up, rightly so, but how did you become to be so interested in the brain and mental health? What was your journey?
It's fairly direct journey, to be honest, and I say that because quite often people come into kind of practitioner psychology therapy as a second career. It's usually something people come into, and it's unusual to go straight in. I knew at 16 that I wanted to be a psychologist. I kind of just followed it in a very kind of straight line, and that came out really of an interest or in people and being a people watcher. I was quite quiet and more of a kind of watcher when I was younger, I guess, more of an introvert, and being curious as to why two people could have a completely different response to the same situation and what was it about them that made that the outcome for them. And then of course, as part of your training, you learn a little about the brain, but then going through my training and my career, actually realizing that as practitioner psychologists, counseling or clinical psychologists, health psychologists, we don't actually think that much about the underlying health of the brain. We think a lot about the outcomes of brain dysfunction in terms of kind of mental illness and depression and issues with maybe self-esteem or personality concerns, but we don't actually think that much about the brain. And it's just a bit of an anomaly in terms of we're helping people work with the outcomes of the functions of their brains, but not thinking about the underlying health of that organ. And so I decided that it would be quite important for me and for my clients for me to have a better understanding of how that worked.
I mean, really fascinating. And I guess for you working in this sphere now has never been a more interesting, unfortunately. And I use that in the words of the Chinese curse, you know, may you live in interesting times. It's, you know, we are obviously living in a very interesting, quote, time globally. And we just seem to be in the middle of this mental health crisis. You know, what is the state of mental health here in the UK from somebody, you know, working right at the sharp end?
Well, it's really pretty bad, to be honest. And I think what the pandemic has done and what it revealed was that it pulled back the veil on the people who were just about coping.
Right.
So we quite often think about the people who are overtly unwell and very visibly unwell. And those are the ones that we talk about most often. But what we miss is this big group of people in the middle, between on the spectrum between wellness and illness, this big group of people who were just about coping, who were very stressed, but were perhaps, you know, coping by exercising a lot or distracting themselves from what was happening at home by being at work, or, you know, just being out every night in order to take their mind off things. And what the pandemic did and what the lockdown did was to take away a lot of people's coping mechanisms.
Right.
And I think what that revealed was a lot of the cracks, both in our general mental health as a population, but also in our service provision.
Mm.
You know, we suddenly were much more aware of the waiting times for eating disorder services, the waiting times for access to psychological therapies, the difficulty to get a GP appointment, all of those things. It really, I think, pulled back the veil on a system which has been on the brink for a very long time. Mm.
There's been a lot of talk, actually, I've seen it on social media, about the extraordinarily, you know, negative impact of lockdowns. And it's just sort of seemed to highlight the fact that we are such social beings. And and actually, you know, locking down the society, I think, has had, I don't know whether you'd agree with this from a professional point of view, but so many more unexpected negative consequences that we perhaps just didn't realise when we were doing it.
I think so. But I think there are a few additional pieces to that. So there was the length of the lockdown to start with. I think had it been shorter,
yes,
you know, this would have been much more manageable for a lot of people. But the nature of the stress, the, you know, unmanageable, uncontrollable stress of suddenly being thrust into the middle of a pandemic is the worst kind of stress for the brain. But then it went on for such a long time. And again, without those coping mechanisms, that it really wore down and undermined what otherwise would have been natural resilience.
Yes.
So I think many more people would have coped had it in the same circumstances over a shorter period of time. But I feel quite keenly that the quality of the messaging was absolutely atrocious and actually added to the psychological burden for a lot of people.
Oh my goodness. I mean, you just couldn't escape it, could you? The extraordinary. I mean, maybe they felt that they had to kind of over egg it to make us take it seriously. But it was really, and still is.
So,
I mean, you see the imagery, the posters, the choice of colours, the black and yellow hazard tape around any kind of picture that was posted. You know, it's all very psychological, isn't it? It feels very kind of psychologically, you know, controlling.
It really is. But and it's terrifying.
Yeah, terrifying.
And I think you're right. At the beginning, it was, they decided that they needed to terrify people into conforming and complying with the rules. But I think that the other part of that, and, you know, I think specifically, is that there is a way to convey difficult information that helps people to feel that it is being managed.
Right. Very good point.
And I think when you are conveying difficult information, you need to be clear. You need to not make promises that you can't keep. Mm. And you need to very, very, be very careful about setting up people's expectations, because we're a species, we're a group of people who will invest in a future outcome. And so we saw it particularly at Christmas, where we were told, you'll definitely have your Christmas, you know, you can have whatever it was at the time, six people or whatever at Christmas. And people, after a long, what had it been, half a year at that point, were looking forward to it and had invested in it. And we start getting our hopes up, and we start putting, you know, pieces of ourselves into this, you know, future event. And then it was very suddenly taken away. And I think that kind of things, it literally sets people up to crash. And I was quite angry about that. And I think when you're conveying difficult information, you need to be very cautious and you need to say, look, I can't promise you this will happen. We will work towards this, but it's contingent on this and this and this. And I don't think that messaging was put across in a psychologically helpful way.
So how important then is hope? Because that's what you're saying, isn't it, really, is that we need to see that there is hope and that the reason we're being asked to do things and do things is because there's going to be a positive and hopeful outcome.
I think hope is hugely important, but I think there's also the skill and the art of containing anxiety. You know, what we had is a very anxious population, and part of the messaging cranked up that anxiety, said you should be worried, this virus is everywhere, it's possibly deadly, we don't know who's got it, some people won't have symptoms. You know, we really cramped up the anxiety on that. But then you can contain that anxiety, or you can do what you can to contain that anxiety. And that comes from, if you think about it, about taking on a good parental role. Like, I'm
reassuring.
In charge. I'm going to do my best to look after you. Yes, be reassuring. Here are the facts. I'm not going to make false promises. And these are the boundaries. And I think we saw other heads of state do that very well. Jacinda Ardern did that very, very well. But actually, I think in the UK, I don't know where this will
global.
Be aired, but I think in the UK, the anxiety, the national anxiety was not very well contained by those who were in the position to do
that. Was that because it's not front of mind? I mean, to you know, excuse the pun, that actually, you know, we're very well used, I think, to dealing with physical illness, perhaps that's very visible and obvious. But perhaps, I mean, maybe certainly at a governmental level, the state of people's mental health and the state of anxiety is perhaps not considered as a really important national asset, if you like.
Absolutely. And I think that's absolutely true. I think because the brain and mental health is out of sight and out of mind, and I think there's still quite a significant stigma around it. You know, shouldn't we just pull ourselves together? It's like the war. Why can't we have blitz spirit, stiff upper lip? You know, this idea that we could just get on with it without recognizing that this was an extraordinary national and global crisis. And therefore, there should have been some forethought in terms of the psychological, the risks of the psychological health of the nation. I think it just wasn't thought about. What occurred to me was when I was watching all of the updates the press conferences was there is absolutely no psychological consultation behind the scenes here. That is absolutely apparent to me.
We need to get you sitting on stage, Kimberly. Clearly, there's a massive role for you here, and I'm sure that people in your profession, you know, are deeply worried and extraordinarily busy. What sort of psychological problems are you seeing as the most common? What sort of things are you facing?
I think we've seen a real increase in or a reduction in just general well-being. People are sleeping much worse than they were before. There's a lot of anxiety, there's a lot of worry, and people not being able to get to sleep. And then that has knock-on effects, because if you can't sleep, you're much less resilient, you're much more anxious, you're much more agitated, you have much less patience, you have poorer concentration, your work suffers, all of that. So sleep problems are up there. We saw a lot of people turning to food or their relationships with food. So either an increase in comfort eating, which, you know, 2 degrees
lockdown
absolutely fine, it's very stressful, is exactly. And that's, you know, I don't think there's any need to condemn that. We saw a lot of people turning to food or their relationships with their bodies, and that in an attempt to gain some sense of control in this uncontrollable situation, people turned to focusing on, well, I'll just get as fit as I can, or I'll, you know, try to lose weight, or I'll try to make sure I don't put on weight. And so there's been a lot of relapse. So I've seen a lot of people who were perhaps managing their eating disorder quite well, or they were okay, they were stable, relapse during
I have
lockdown.
Heard that actually. I mean, I've got two young daughters, and I'm, you know, relatively plugged into their age group, sort of in their 20s. And the number of eating disorders that I'm now aware of in that circle is really terrifying, actually. And I think that's very interesting, your point about it being an element of life that they feel they can control, perhaps, and everything else is outside of their control, but controlling what they eat and controlling their bodies. And it's a big legacy. And I think at the moment, sadly, there don't seem to be many provisions for young people. What sort of resources do you point people in the direction of, if we've got people who are listening who perhaps are affected or have people in their families or circle of friends who are affected, where would you point them to?
Well, you would point them towards your GP. I'm kind of in the opposite position because most people come to me after having been on the waiting list for a long time for NHS services. And they've decided that they can't wait, or it's kind of risky for them to wait longer. So I will either refer to, you know, my network of colleagues, whether they are dietitians, psychiatrists, other psychologists. But I think the real problem is that there is really inadequate provision, and there's been big investment in terms of young people with eating disorders, but there are a lot of older people, older women who have been suffering with an eating disorder all of their adult lives, and it's just been either because it was a generation where women were expected to just maintain a particular physique and therefore it wasn't really questioned, or because by now they think, well, actually, this is a teenage or a young person's illness and it's embarrassing or somehow shameful to go to their doctor in their 30s, 40s or 50s and say, actually, I struggle with this. That there are this lost generation of women who have been struggling with their diet and with their bodies for a very, very long time, for whom I'm not convinced the provision really exists in an adequate way to serve them.
That's not good news. Well, hopefully by raising awareness of it, we can at least start those conversations and see, you know, what we can do. I mean, this is very much, you know, campaigning and raising awareness, a lot of what we do at Lizard Wellbeing here. Absolutely. How much control can we have over our mental health, do you think? I mean, coming back to basics, how much of it is genetic? It's the deck of cards that we're dealt at birth. And how much is actually within our own influence?
So what the research is showing us is that there is an increasing understanding that we have some influence over our general psychological well-being. And that's really good news, given the context of, you know, the things we've just been discussing in terms of poor provision and overstretched services. The idea that there is something that you can do to support yourself is really, really both empowering, but essential in terms of keeping people as well as possible for as long as possible. So whilst things like the heritability, so the kind of genetic association of someone's depression might be somewhere in the region of kind of 30 to 50%, you know, the old adage that the genetics loads the gun, but it doesn't put, it's the environment that puts the trigger.
That's a good, I've never heard that one before. That's really good to know. You can have a loaded gun, but actually that trigger doesn't have to be pulled.
It doesn't have to be pulled, and that there are things that you can do to mitigate. And actually and I say this very, very cautiously, because what I don't want people to go away with the idea of is that this is all personal responsibility. And if you have depression, it's because you haven't tried hard enough. That's not the case at all. But it's about saying, really, if depression, for example, is an outcome, a feature of your brain, the function and dysfunction of your brain, then supporting your brain health is going to support those outcomes. In the same way that if high blood pressure is a function of the health of your heart and your arteries, then doing things in your lifestyle to help support the health of your heart and your arteries is going to have beneficial effects on your blood pressure. It might not solve it, and if you have genetic heart disease, it's not going to fix it, but it could help to mitigate. And so, for example, we know that improving nutrition, so moving people from maybe a highly processed or Western style diet, and Professor Julia Rutledge is, you know, says every single time I speak to her, there is absolutely no study that shows that a Western diet is good for mental health. You know, there are lots of studies showing that the Mediterranean diet is good for mental health, but the diet that most of us in the West are eating, and that children are increasingly eating, one that is kind of highly processed, high in free sugars, high in salt and fat, has never been shown to be supportive of mental health, and quite the opposite. In studies where you can do interventions where, you know, you put someone on a more Western style diet or you increase their intake of these nutrients, they have poorer mental health outcomes. They have more depression, they have poorer sleep, they have more anxiety. And so we know that improving nutrition for lots of different reasons improves brain health and mental health outcomes. The same with exercise. So improving, increasing regular physical activity in any way that feels good for you is protective against depression and helps to manage and reduce anxiety. And, you know, and that's so important because these disorders, they're called the common mental health disorders, anxiety and depression, are the ones that afflict, you know, sometimes 50, 60% of the population. And so if you can give people that information and empower them with that knowledge that a few little tweaks, you know, I start people off and I say, can you take a 5-minute walk every morning? Because actually it's more about consistency than effort. I don't want you to go out and start running 10K every other day. If we can start with consistency and getting you moving and helping you to build that into a habit, then actually what we're building is what I call whole body mental health, influencing how your body works, which includes your brain, to help improve your mental health outcomes.
I love that. That is just so very positive.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Can we take a look now at food? I know that's a big part of your work, and obviously it's a big part of my work too. And I'm really interested in linking food with mental health and nutrition particularly. What kind of things could we be eating for improved mood? Are there such foods?
Well, yes and no. So no in the sense that having a salad isn't just going to make you feel better within the next half hour. But yes, in terms of the epidemiology, so the big observational studies that look at 10,000, 15,000 people, the prospective studies which look at people's diet at baseline and then their risk of developing depression over several years, and the intervention studies, so taking people with depression and a poor diet, changing their diet, all of these come together to show us that improving your nutrition can reduce your risk and severity of depression. The foods that seem to be most important for that seem at the moment to be, and this is literally the hill I will die on, omega-3 fatty acids. So flying the flag, tooting the horn, like I really need people to understand the importance of these fats for brain health and brain structure. They are structural fats. They are the building blocks. They form at least 30% of the outer membrane of your brain cells. And so if you, and you can only get them through the diet. So, and I, the analogy I use is of a house. If you're building a house, if your brain is a house that is being built, not having these fats in your diet is like taking one in every three bricks out of that house. The house will still stand, but it's going to be much more vulnerable.
Do you worry then for vegans and vegetarians who may be low in omega-3s? Is there a link then with poorer mental health outcomes?
I do worry. I privately and quietly, I worry. I've done a couple of podcasts and certainly posts on my social media to ensure that people who don't eat animal foods are understanding the importance of these nutrients for their overall brain health. Because what will often happen is that someone will switch to a vegan diet, often without knowing that meat isn't just protein or animal foods aren't just protein. They also contain really important nutrients like the omega-3 fats, like B12. B12, which again is predominantly, if not exclusively, found in animal foods, is so important to brain function that deficiency in B12 can mimic dementia. And if you don't know that, and then you switch to a fully plant-based diet, then you're going to start, you know, initially people tend to feel better, often because they're eating more fruits and vegetables. But over time, when they start to feel fatigued, loss of energy, a little bit forgetful, they're much less likely to think, is it something that I'm not eating? Because we have this idea that meat and fish is just about protein. And actually people, if you're going to cut something out of your diet, you need to understand what effect it might have on your brain health. And for example, with the B vitamins, so thinking about what's called mild cognitive impairment, which is not necessarily definitely going to lead to Alzheimer's disease, but it's often a precursor to Alzheimer's disease. So it's a kind of forgetfulness, poorer concentration, more difficulty following a conversation that's associated with, you know, we call it normal brain aging. But people with mild cognitive impairment, when you supplement them with omega-3s and B vitamins, have much slower decline in their brain health. So essentially their brains age much more slowly than people who aren't getting those nutrients. So omega-3s, B vitamins, brightly colored foods, those would be the ones that I would always direct people to. Those leafy green vegetables, for example, there was a lovely study which showed that, again, older people who ate leafy green vegetables every day, just a handful, had brains that were 11 years younger than their peers.
11 years younger. That's phenomenal.
Isn't it just extraordinary?
Just some veggies.
Just a few greens. You know, the amount of spinach that you throw into a sandwich, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? I love that. You know, small change, big difference. I mean, that is really, without medicalizing it, that is so empowering. One of the things that I'm particularly keen to talk to you about, Kimberly, is your work in prisons. And this is something that I have often thought about. And if you'll indulge me just for a couple of minutes, just to talk about my take on this. And there
of
are two
course,
things, really.
Please.
One is I've been looking at work with brain chemistry, looking at high levels of copper and low levels of zinc, increasing the risk of violent and aggressive tendencies, and how that has been shown in young offenders, prisons where young men particularly have been tested and they've been found to have these nutritional deficiencies. And I just think that is tragic if they are, you know, there because something has been triggered by a nutritional deficit. And the other one is I really wanted to do a study, and maybe you can help me in the future, we could work on this. I know that you talk a lot about the gut-brain axis, and so do I, is the role of probiotics. And again, looking at some of the specific probiotics in terms of, again, you know, aggression and calm and the production of oxytocin and all these good positive hormones. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it be amazing to do a clinically controlled trial where you're giving kind of like kefir every morning to prisoners, who would be a great control group because they can't go anywhere. They haven't got access to, you know, to eating anything else. And just seeing how mood and behavior changes. I mean, what do you think to those kinds of things?
It's it was the first, and it really should have triggered a sea change in the way we think about nutrition, and it should have really shaken the entire British judicial system. And so it was a study that was published in 2002, and it looked at the impact of improving nutrition on young offenders. And so it took a group of young offenders, a few hundred young men, and split them into two groups. And you're absolutely right. It's a very good environment for a controlled trial, because as long as you get the buy-in from the rest of the prison and they're not kind of sent off into other locations, they're there. And so they gave half of the young men a placebo, and they gave the other half a nutritional supplement, omega-3s, vitamins and minerals, for 8 weeks. And what they found at the end of the study, and they were looking at objective incidents of violence. So when you work in prison, when there's something that goes off on the wing, and maybe a wing is, say, 50 men, there's the officers or the adjudication book that sits in the office at the end of the wing. And if there's a fight, or if there's an incident of self-harm, or if someone smashes up their cell, it goes in the book. And so this is what they were looking at in terms of counting how many incidents there were. And in the supplemented group, they found a 30% reduction in incidents of violence.
In 8 weeks.
Compared to placebo. Yeah. And that was in 2002, right? So this is 19 years ago, nearly 20 years ago. And I spoke to the lead researcher on that study, and he said that they were asked to do an economical analysis to find out how much it would cost in order to roll this out, because obviously, prisons are very violent. It can be very violent places. And particularly if you think about lockdown, when people were only getting half an hour a day, if they're out of their cells, it becomes a very fraught, very stressful place. It's very difficult for staff. Morale can be incredibly low. So violence is a big financial and safety issue. And they did an economic analysis, and it turned out that it might cost something like 10 or 11 pence a day to supply these supplements to the prisoners. So that's one big study, and that's really important, but it's just one study. And what's important in science is replication. And actually, they have replicated this. So in 2012, they did another replication in the Netherlands in the prisons, and they found a bigger effect. They found, I think it was 34% improvement, but in that study, the control group got worse. So the actual difference was something like 45% in terms of incidents of violence. And then last year, there was another replication in Southeast Asia and Singapore. So we actually have a lot of randomized control trials, the kind of gold standard in terms of causation data, demonstrating that if you take a group of prisoners and improve their nutrition, you reduce violence, you improve behavior, you improve outcomes. And I am astounded, dismayed, shocked, that we are doing absolutely nothing with this evidence.
It is chilling to hear about that. And the cost is so small, the benefit is so great, the downside is zero. And not only we talk about mental health and improvement in prisons and safety of staff and better outcomes for the prisoners when they're released, but also think about the health benefits, you know, the lack of draw on the health service later, helping to ward off degenerative disease.
Absolutely.
It is just astounding. I seriously hope that there are a lot of people listening today who are perhaps in some way connected in towers of power somewhere, be they, you know, related to prisons or judiciary or you know, public health, because it just seems like a no-brainer. And I guess when you expand that also out to a wider society, if you're saying that it improves aggressive behavior or diminishes it by 30%, that is going to be the same for the outside community. So obviously not everyone who has aggressive tendencies is going to be in prison. They're going to be a significant number of them, you know, outside. And we think about things like domestic violence as well, and all sorts of other areas of, you know, and gang culture with young people. Surely if we start to get our whole society onto better nutrition, it does seem like an enormous mountain to climb though, doesn't it?
It really does. And, you know, I talk about this quite a lot, these prison studies. And I understand, and I think particularly if you haven't worked in prison, I can understand that people don't really have much sympathy for prisoners. You know, they've done the crime, and why should we be taking, you know, a soft position on them? But I think the bigger story and the greater tragedy here is that we see the same effects in children. And that's both with child hunger and also child malnutrition. And it, of course, because children's brains are rapidly developing, children's brains can be using up about, you know, sometimes 60% of their energy demand.
Gosh.
You know, your brain is incredibly hungry and incredibly nutritionally demanding. And children who are hungry, so again, I was speaking to Carmel McConnell, who runs Magic Breakfast, who founded the charity. And I was telling her about this research. And she said, well, we see the same thing in our schools. When we're onboarding a school, we'll look at their rates of fights, for example, in the children. And she said, when we compared the children who were the school that was onboarding, so weren't having breakfasts at that point, with the children who were, there was a 30% reduction in fights in first play in the children who were having breakfast. And when you think about the importance of being, you know, well behaved for children in their academic and educational achievement, it's actually really important, right? Being able to sit still, being able to focus, to concentrate, to not be labeled as the naughty one, to not be sent outside to keep you from disrupting the rest of the class, all of this. And to think that at least for some of those children, some of those children who are at greater risk of being expelled because of their behaviour, or who find it difficult to concentrate because, you know, their brains literally can't settle, to think that that could be improved by either breakfast or improved nutrition through a supplement or something like that. Again, it's a huge indictment on our society that children might be suffering in this way for lack of adequate food.
Yeah, absolutely. And talking about food, you've obviously talked about the things that we should be looking at to improve and include the B12, the omega-3s, lots of lovely green leafy veg and all of that. What about the things that we should be limiting? Are there things out there that are dominating our diet that are actually, you know, contributing to this?
Yes. And, you know, whilst I typically, and I tend to have, you know, a food positive approach, you know, there's room for everything and let's not demonize food. If we're really thinking specifically about brain health and kind of mental health outcomes, there's really, I'm afraid to say, no good news about sugar sweetened beverages.
There is not.
Really isn't. And even, you know, in studies where they've taken, again, healthy young men and given them 3 sugar sweetened beverages a week, so not a huge amount, and we can imagine that people are drinking, and other studies have looked at 600 mils a day, which would be kind of 2 cans a day. But across the spectrum, what you see very, very quickly are increases in markers of systemic inflammation. So their C-reactive protein, their levels of these cytokines in their bloodstream go up, which is not good, because what we don't want is too much elevated inflammation, because that can cross over into the brain and cause kind of negative outcomes for the brain. And also, again, on a kind of, there was a study that looked at just 1 week on a Western style diet. So they took, again, healthy people and had them have 2 Belgian waffles for breakfast. And then through the day for the week, they said, can you have one kind of fast food
just
meal
one.
Deal every day?
Mm-hmm.
Just one. And what they found was an impairment in what's called hippocampal dependent learning. So the hippocampus is the part of the brain which is essential for learning and memory. It's the part of the brain that is most damaged in Alzheimer's disease. So it's your seat of memory. It coordinates your memories and organizes it's the gateway for your memories. And it's therefore also really important for learning, organizing, you know, where did I learn that? And how do I put that together? And where do I remember that from? And within a week, there was impairments in the structure and function of the hippocampus on a Western style diet.
That is 7 days. Just staggering.
And so again, when we're thinking about social inequalities and health inequalities and children who have had no other option but to eat a particular type of diet because it's all that they could afford, then actually we're thinking that simply for the misfortune of having been born poor, that these children are going to have differences in the way that their brains develop. And obviously all of the kind of downstream outcomes of that?
I guess the only bit of good news here, coming back to that, I'm desperately trying to find something, coming back to that word earlier, hope, is that we do know that these studies exist. We are aware of the information. Yes, there is, in my opinion, a massive disinformation campaign and a suppression of certain bits of information by those whose objectives it doesn't suit. But there are hopefully enough people out there to make a noise and to care, like you do, to want to get this information across. And we just have to keep on keeping on, don't you think? I mean, we just have to keep talking about it, to spread the word, to share the information, to try and empower others and try and limit the kind of, it's often not even disinformation, it's just the suppression of the information that's there. But just bring it out and shine a light on it. And I think what's been very interesting for me working in this space over the last few years and interviewing lots of really experienced, wonderful people like yourself is how many people do actually just get quashed and or even, you know, sort of deliberately trolled to try and kind of put them off talking about these things. But, you know, I guess you need to be a well-being warrior here, don't you? And just continue. What motivates you to spur you on? Because talking about your work and presumably, you know, going into prisons and seeing firsthand the damage that is being done, how do you personally fortify yourself and carry on?
Well, I think I'm mostly fueled by rage, actually.
That's a good one.
And so particularly with these, because you're absolutely right. When I spoke to Dr. Bernard Gesch, who did the first 2002, the Aylesbury study, and I spoke to him and I said, you know, this is incredible research. And he said, yes, I know. he said, but no one's listening anymore. No one's listening. I've tried to talk, you know, and he spent 20 years trying to get this information actioned, and he's tired, you know, just listening to him. He was just exhausted. And I became furious on his behalf, you know, that he'd done. We talk about investing in research and following the science, and this is good quality science with a big effect size and outcomes that really affect the whole of society. Because when prisoners are released from society, they're back to being our neighbours and the people we work with and our delivery, you know, all of that. So this has huge implications for society. And I just think it's outrageous that the Home Office, you know, the MOJ is doing nothing with it. And I'm a big proponent of utilising anger appropriately. And I guess this is, you know, talking about anger and kind of mitigating anger. But anger is an emotion. A, it's an emotion of defense when you think, when you see something that's unjust and you want to improve things. So it's your signal. I always say to my clients and patients, you know, it's your, if you feel anger, it's a signal of injustice, either that you recognize in the world around you or that you're experiencing yourself. And if you can listen to that and understand what you think is unfair, then you are in a much better position to then do what you can and channel that feeling into trying to do something about it. So I just stay angry.
Kimberly, it's such a delight to talk to you. I would love to talk to you again because I just feel that we've only just touched on so many vitally important things. I'd love to do more to be able to share and amplify the work that you're doing. It's so important. I know that you've spoken today on so many extraordinarily helpful and positive messages. I hope that everybody who's been listening will share this widely and raise awareness and feel the anger and channel it in a very positive way. I'm so grateful for your time today. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so, so much. It's been lovely. Thank you for indulging me.
Well, I hope you feel both inspired, empowered, and perhaps enraged in equal measures. And that is it for today's episode. Huge thanks to Kimberly. And as always, you will find all the links and the resources that we mentioned over on lizellewellbeing.com. And there you can sign up for the free weekly newsletter filled with plenty of healthy omega-3 filled recipes and more, and tips for living really well. Huge thanks to all of you who have left us such lovely reviews, particularly on iTunes. Super grateful. It really does help others to find the show, as does clicking those little 5-star review buttons at the end of this podcast broadcast. So thank you. And until the next time, go well. Bye-bye. The Lizelle Wellbeing Show is presented by me, Lizelle, with production by Amara Lizelle and Harry Trevithick at Heart Dialogue. With grateful thanks to my producer, Ellie Smith, assistant researcher, Martha Comerford, and guest booker, Millie de la Morinière.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.